At the Copenhagen Conference this week and next, we'll be hearing a lot about one number in particular, 2 degrees Celsius, or 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. Industrialized countries hope they can limit global warming to that figure. We ask NPR's Richard Harris to look at how scientists arrived at that number in the first place.
In 1992, the nations of the world signed onto a treaty in which they agreed to prevent dangerous interference with the Earth's climate. There's no easy way to define dangerous, but scientists like Michael Oppenheimer at Princeton began thinking about how much delicate ecosystems like coral reefs and human systems like agriculture could tolerate.
And ultimately, numbers in the range of 2 degrees Celsius began to surface.
Studies over the years kept coming back to that number, so the European Union decided to adopt 2 degrees as its climate change limit. Earlier this year, most of the other industrialized countries, including the United States, adopted it as well. End of story? Not quite.
There's a new concern over the last 5 years or so with the ice sheets.
Greenland and Antarctica might start to melt rapidly, even at 2 degrees of warming, pushing sea level up as much as 6 feet this century, and more after that. Also, African delegates in Copenhagen are none too happy with a 2-degree goal. Lumumba Diaping from Sudan says if the globe warms 2 degrees on average, Africa would heat up by substantially more. Diaping says that would turn Africa into a furnace.
2 degrees is a certain death for Africa.
Indeed, 2 degrees is a judgment call, not settled science. And, by the way, the globe has already heated up 0.7 of a degree since pre-industrial times. More heating is inevitable, so we're already well on our way to 2 degrees Celsius. Richard Harris, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Today, the Obama administration extended the controversial Troubled Asset Relief Program, known as TARP. In a letter to Congress, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner said TARP would operate through early October of next year. That extension came as TARP received a report card from the panel that Congress appointed to oversee it. NPR's John Itzde has both stories.
The report from the Congressional Oversight Panel was really an assessment of the TARP's performance during its first year. And despite the controversy surrounding the program, panel member Richard Nieman said that TARP had succeeded in its basic mission.
The report clearly gives credit to TARP for having achieved the primary objective of restoring general financial stability and liquidity in the financial system.
But Nieman, who is also New York State's superintendent of banks, said the $700 billion program faced challenges in achieving its other goals.
And those revolve around the increasing foreclosures that are facing our country, as well as issues around credit availability, particularly for small businesses.
Over the past year, most TARP resources have gone to shore up large Wall Street banks and financial institutions. But the injections of capital have not succeeded in providing enough credit for many small businesses to create jobs. In his letter notifying Congress of the program's extension, Secretary Geithner said that in the coming year, the TARP program would focus on providing lending to small businesses, along with additional efforts to head off foreclosures. Former IMF chief economist Simon Johnson is skeptical.
Well, I think that won't make much difference, to be honest, unfortunately. That refocusing is mostly for political reasons.
Johnson, now an MIT professor, says only the recovery of the economy will make a significant difference in small business job creation and a reduction in mortgage foreclosures. Johnson says the TARP program needed to be extended because the financial system still faces challenges from shaky credit card and mortgage financing. But he said the terms for recipients of aid should be tougher in the future.
Much tougher, much more favorable to the taxpayer, and less favorable to the bankers who make the big bad mistakes.
Secretary Geithner suggested in his letter that in the end, the TARP program would cost taxpayers around $140 billion. Bank of America said today it has completed repayment of the $45 billion it owed the TARP. John Itzde, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Children who have trouble reading usually do a lot better if they receive intensive instruction, and now scientists have discovered one reason why. As NPR's John Hamilton reports, a new study shows that intensive reading programs produce measurable changes in the structure of a child's brain.
Reading involves a lot of different parts of the brain. Some recognize letters, others apply knowledge about vocabulary and syntax, and still others decide what it all means. Somehow, the brain has to synchronize all these operations. Marcel Just, who directs the Center for Cognitive Brain Imaging at Carnegie Mellon University, says that requires a really good communication system.
You need these sort of high-speed, I don't know what to call them, highways between brain areas to let the information flow back and forth extremely effectively.
If those information highways can't handle the traffic, the brain won't be able to make sense out of the text. Just wondered whether this might be part of the problem for a lot of children struggling to read. So he and a colleague named Timothy Keller used a special type of MRI to look at the brains of several dozen poor readers as young as 8. The team focused on the network of fibers that carries information around the brain. That's a kind of brain tissue called white matter.
Tim Keller and I scanned these children and found that there was an area of white matter that was of lower structural quality than in the control group.
The control group being kids with typical reading skills. During the next school year, some of the poor readers were enrolled in programs that provided a total of 100 hours of intensive remedial instruction.
These children were really practicing how to read words, how to sound out words and read sentences over and over and over again. And that repeated remediation training is what changed not just their reading ability, but changed the tissues in their brain.
A second round of MRI scans showed that the quality of white matter had improved in the same areas found to be lacking before the kids got intensive instruction. Just says there was no change among children in standard classes, and he says
the amount of improvement in the white matter in an individual was correlated with that individual's improvement in his reading ability.
The finding adds to the evidence that learning involves more than just gray matter, the brain tissues that process and store information. Doug Fields works in the Child Health and Human Development section at the National Institutes of Health. He says the realization that white matter is also important for learning has led to a shift in the way many scientists view the brain.
By analogy, we were looking at a transistor, and now we're looking at the whole network, like the internet, and realizing for this whole network to operate, you need to have an efficient flow of information.
Fields says other studies have shown that white matter also changes when people learn to juggle or play a musical instrument. And he says white matter seems to be involved in a wide range of brain function and dysfunction.
Psychiatric illnesses, mathematical ability, IQ. Really, the more we look, the more we find.
Marcel Just says there's even evidence linking autism to problems with white matter and a lack of synchrony in the brain. The new study appears in the journal Neuron. John Hamilton, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. And there is reaction today and more details trickling out about a potential deal on health care. A small group of Senate Democrats reached that deal yesterday. They're trying to free the overhaul bill from a state of legislative limbo. And 5 moderates and 5 liberals may have found a compromise on a government-sponsored health insurance option, a compromise that could win the magic 60 votes. NPR's Julie Rovner has the latest.
No one's quite sure exactly what's in the package that's now getting its cost estimated by the Congressional Budget Office, but President Obama took a minute from a community health center event this afternoon to praise the potential compromise anyway.
The Senate made critical progress last night with a creative new framework that I believe will help pave the way for final passage and a historic achievement on behalf of the American people. I support this effort.
Whether or not the plan includes a public option will apparently come down to a semantic distinction. There will likely be a role for the Federal Office of Personnel Management. It now oversees the hundreds of private plans that cover 9 million federal workers and their families, including members of Congress. Exactly what the OPM would oversee under the new plan remains unclear. More clear, however, is that the package includes a proposal to let older uninsured people buy into Medicare coverage early. That pleases senators like West Virginia Democrat Jay Rockefeller, who's been pushing for such a change for years.
I would love to get that. What? That's 55 to 64 years old. That's a lot of people, and it's really good.
Good is not the word Republicans are using to describe the idea, particularly after they've spent most of the past week castigating Democrats for cutting Medicare spending in the bill. Here's Tennessee's Lamar Alexander.
How in the world can we take $1 trillion out of Medicare and give 34 or 35 million more Americans a chance to opt in it at a time when the trustees of Medicare have said it's going broke in 5 years?
Now, Alexander's numbers don't quite add up. No one's talking about adding that many more people to the program. But the sentiment that adding more people to Medicare at a time when it's clearly having financial problems is one that's shared not just by Republicans, but by health care provider groups. And unlike Republicans, some of those provider groups have been major backers of the health overhaul effort. Take the American Hospital Association.
No one wants to see expanded coverage more than America's hospitals.
That's AHA Executive Vice President Rick Pollack.
However, we're extremely concerned about this kind of an approach because it moves people away from the private sector into government programs that are chronically underfunded.
Pollack says the average hospital already gets about 40% of its revenues from Medicare.
And Medicare pays less than the cost of delivering services. And as more patients are reimbursed at levels that are below the cost of providing the service, it obviously makes it difficult to maintain essential public services that patients and communities depend upon.
Hospitals typically make up that shortfall by passing the cost to privately insured patients who pay more. That's made the idea of letting younger patients join Medicare a non-starter with the insurance industry, too. Robert Zirkelbach is a spokesman for America's health insurance plans.
Families and employers are paying higher premiums to offset under-reimbursements from the Medicare program today. Expanding the number of people that participate in the Medicare program will exacerbate this underfunding and increase costs for people with private coverage.
There's another element of the emerging compromise that's drawn fire from the insurance industry. Insurers may be required to spend 90% of each premium dollar on direct health care services and only 10% on administrative costs. But Zirkelbach says that could curtail some of the very programs the government wants to expand.
Quote, administrative costs include programs such as disease management, care coordination, prevention and wellness. All of these things have broad support.
Senate Democrats are meeting tonight to go over the deal. They need all 60 members of their caucus to move the bill to a final vote. And it's not clear whether brand new ideas like a Medicare buy-in will get them the votes they need. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
With all the news about the war in Afghanistan, we have some recommendations for books about that country. These suggestions come from Nadim Aslam, whose latest novel, The Wasted Vigil, takes place in post-9/11 Afghanistan. Here are three other books on Afghanistan.
Times as complex as ours present us with huge moral dilemmas and require minds that need to be sharp. The following three books deepen our understanding of the news reports from Afghanistan. When the United States was attacked on 9/11, the reaction of many was, who are these people? Why did they do this? The Looming Tower by Lawrence Wright takes us back 30 years. It was 1979 when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan. The United States and other Western countries decided that billions of dollars would be funneled into Afghanistan to help the Mujahideen defeat the Soviets. When the Soviets were defeated a decade later, the West turned its gaze away from the region, and Afghan warlords plunged Afghanistan into a bloody civil war. And then 9/11 happened. The Looming Tower is a very important book about consequences. This book charts it all, the Cold War years and how they were cold only for the privileged places of the planet, how the Cold War was actually a hot war in places like Afghanistan. The book explains the creation of the Taliban and the gradual coming together of Al-Qaeda. If you have ever wondered who the suicide bombers are, where they came from, this is the book for you. My next choice is The Punishment of Virtue. Its author, Sarah Chase, reported from Pakistan and Afghanistan in the autumn of 2001. After decades of war, most of Afghanistan was like a shipwreck. In the words of W.H. Auden, a preserved disaster. And after the Taliban fell, she decided to stay, to see what could be salvaged from the wreck, to see if she could help with the rebuilding of that nation. She dressed like a man, met warlords, opium dealers, had meetings with President Karzai, and the result is this clear-eyed and extraordinary book. My last selection is Earth and Ashes by Atiq Rahimi. This is a brilliant novel from a brilliant Afghanistani poet who now lives in Paris. Earth and Ashes tells the story of the years of the Soviet occupation of the 1980s. In it, an old man and his little grandson take a journey across the war-torn landscape to bring a piece of news to the boy's father, who is a coal miner. It is a tragic book, and it is a book about nobility. And I use these words in the sense that George Orwell used them when he said, "A tragic situation exists precisely when virtue does not triumph, but when it is still felt that man is nobler than the forces which destroy him." The point of art and literature is to reduce the distance between two human beings. When I look at a beautiful mountain in Yellowstone Park or a river in China, I don't say to myself how beautiful the United States or China is. I say how beautiful this planet is. And similarly, these books help us see Afghanistan's problems as our own.
That's Nadim Aslam. His latest novel is called The Wasted Vigil. The three books he recommended are Earth and Ashes by Atiq Rahimi, The Punishment of Virtue by Sarah Chase, who once reported from Afghanistan for NPR, and The Looming Tower by Lawrence Wright. You can find more reading suggestions and end-of-the-year lists of the best books of 2009 at npr.org.
And when you fly these days, it can be pretty exciting if you're offered some peanuts or pretzels. First class, of course, is more luxurious, but there is a select group of travelers for whom airlines will go to almost any lengths. NPR's Ben Bergman tries to uncover the world of secret frequent flyer programs.
In the new movie Up in the Air, George Clooney plays a road warrior who spends a lot of time in the air, 322 days a year.
To know me is to fly with me. This is where I live.
For his loyalty, American Airlines rewards Clooney's character Ryan Bingham with a graphite frequent flyer card. It entitles him to many benefits, not least of which is impressing female travelers with his membership.
Oh my God. I wasn't sure these actually existed. This is the American Airlines...
Yeah, it's a concierge key, yeah.
What is that? Carbon fiber?
Graphite.
Oh, God, I love the weight.
I was pretty excited the day that bad boy came in.
Yeah, I'll say.
The movie is fictional, but filmmakers work closely with American Airlines to make it as realistic as possible. So even though it's not mentioned anywhere on American's website, there really is such a thing as the concierge key program, says company spokesman Billy Sanez.
The concierge key program is an exclusive program that American Airlines has for our very top customers. This is by invitation only and an extremely exclusive club.
Just how exclusive? Sanez will only say membership is limited to a select few.
And we know them all very, very well.
Of several airlines contacted for this story, American was the only one wanting to talk on tape. And even then, Sanez was coy on the details of who gets in or what exactly the benefits are.
We don't share the details of that because it's very exclusive, but we have a philosophy in that program that we really, really, really take care of our customer.
There have been stories about airlines holding the plane until a VIP customer arrives, or even arranging for a helicopter to fetch someone stuck in traffic. In the movie, when Clooney's character reaches 10 million miles, he gets a private line to make reservations or whatever request he wants, plus...
lifetime executive status. You get to meet the chief pilot, Maynard Finch, and they put your name on the side of a plane.
Travel consultant and writer Joel Widzer says he once worked for an executive who belonged to one of these real-life secret frequent flyer programs. The executive was on his way to an important meeting, only to have his flight canceled. So he called the airline.
The person on the other end had told him, he said, "Sir, we have arranged for you a private flight that will take you to your destination, and you will arrive to your meeting promptly and on time."
Talk about service. Now, sending a private jet is the extreme example. More common are instant upgrades, escorts to help make tight connections and not having to pay all those baggage and change fees. To get in, it's not as important how much you fly as how much you spend. Buying full fare helps, even better if you're a CEO or travel manager who can steer a lot of revenue to the airline. just don't ask to be let in.
It becomes sort of like a skull and bone society. And they don't want people to know that some of these people are getting these special perks.
Despite having flown over 200,000 miles a year on Delta, Widzer wasn't invited to join the airline's most elite program. He suspects Delta didn't want him writing about all the special things they do for their favorite customers while the rest of us fight for a pillow. But Jason Reitman, who directed Up in the Air, was asked to join American's VIP program after his movie started production. So that's one way to get in. Ben Bergman, NPR News.